Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. Show obviously available as a podcast, also available on iTunes, and all of the podcasts here at WFYI are available on Spotify. Well, hopefully this weekend will be a lot calmer than last weekend, but we did get through another week, so I hope everybody is staying safe and healthy and sane and hopefully watching some movies that are giving you some escape, especially in the last week or so. No interviews, so it's just basically I'll tell you what I saw this week, and then we'll go to what you saw and posted on my Facebook and Twitter page. So thank you much for everybody's contribution. It's exciting when people chime in early and are really excited to want to let me know what they've watched. So it's been very, very cool. So thank you. So one of the things I've been watching throughout the week, and I will be honest with you, I thought it was a film, and it actually turned out to be a series that is now available on Netflix, Amazon Prime, and Hulu, among others. It's a Dutch crime series called The Day, or The Dag, pardon my Dutch. And it's a multi-part, I believe it's 12-part episodes. I'm at episode 8. So I'll give another roundup review at the next week's show, but it's a situation of a bank heist with hostages that's of course not going according to plan, and the series alternates between the point of view of the police and the robbers and the hostages. So it goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And if you're really into procedural dramas, you're going to like this. It took a little bit of time for me to get used to it and get into it. This is not my fifth genre of choice. But it is interesting to go back from what happened with one section of the day to, so kind of a Rashomon aspect of that. So anyway, look for The Day or Die Dag, D-A-G. Again, it's Dutch, but it's okay. Crimes and police procedures and hostages are universal. But The Day is available on Netflix, Amazon Prime, and Hulu, among others. So go check that out. Now, and like I said, I'll wrap it up with next week's program. I know last year, the pop culture world gave a bit of a ribbing to Bruce Lee because of the treatment of Bruce Lee's the Bruce Lee persona in Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Actually, it's Quentin's digging of Tarantino of Bruce Lee more than anybody else. So, and I know that was I shouldn't say it's one of the biggest controversies of that film. Some say that the film's very violent and the revisionist history for those who had not seen Tarantino's other revisionist history films. But the treatment of Bruce Lee, and Tarantino claims that he is a cocky individual and probably was, but he was able to back it up. But that's okay. We are now in the revitalization of Bruce Lee's persona because two things are coming up. In July, the Criterion Collection is putting out a really cool collector set called Bruce Lee: His Greatest Hits. It's the films, folks. It's Big Boss, Fist of Fury, Enter the Dragon, Year of the Dragon, and Game of Death, as well as a slew of documentaries, commentary tracks, all that stuff. I've already pre-ordered mine, so I am anxious to get this on my hands. And this weekend on ESPN, as a part of their 30 for 30 documentary series, a really cool one called Be Water, which is about Bruce Lee's life and career. Another example of nonlinear storytelling use for good use. It begins with a screen test he did in Hollywood in the early 60s, and talked about how after the success and then quick cancellation of The Green Hornet, tried and had small parts in some movies and TV, most notably films like Marlowe with James Garner, Here Come the Brides, Ironside, Longstreet. And of course, he pitched the TV series Kung Fu, and then they didn't cast him in it. So in 1971, he goes back to Hong Kong after spending 12 years in Hollywood and bangs out four films in 2 years, those being The Big Boss, Fist of Fury, Year of the Dragon, and then Enter the Dragon. And so anyway, it talks about that work as well as his early years, especially in doing movies as young as age 9, the 1960, I believe it was no, he played a juvenile delinquent in the 1960 Hong Kong drama The Orphan, but was in movies as early as age 9. So I know on the Enter the Dragon collection on Warner Brothers Home Video that there is a documentary about Lee, and as I've said before, and this is a Matt problem, this is a me problem, that if you make a documentary and I know everything about it, then it's a bit of a problem for me. Then it wasn't made for me, it was made for somebody who, it might be Bruce Lee 101. And that's not entirely the case with Bewater. There's a lot of interviews, there's new interviews with his wife, his siblings, his kids, actors and friends from his younger days. So there's a lot of new talking head material, voiceover material, and a lot of footage and photographs I had not seen before. I knew of his friendships and workings and teachings, actually teaching karate martial arts to the likes of Steve McQueen and James Coburn. That's territory I already knew, but for a lot, maybe they did not. But there's a lot of cool interview and home movie footage. Another one of his students, of course, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, that I had not seen. So I think that's a plus for me. And I think, and it's been a while since Enter the Dragon came out on Warner Brother Home Video, but I believe this is going to get a whole new audience because of ESPN 30 for 30. So I do recommend it very much. It's really cool work. And if this makes you go out and check out more of Bruce Lee's work, especially Enter the Dragon, which has a special place in my household because it was the first R-rated film I showed my daughter Emma. So she had already seen Rumble in the Bronx, and I thought you need to see what many considered the greatest martial arts film ever made. And I know my buddy Jenny White says it's Five Fingers of Death. We will have to have this debate someday on the show, someday. So anyway, that's the new material I got to see this week. Going back to the collection that I have, a stack of movies that I just have not even touched yet, because of last week's show, and a couple people had chimed in about the film version of Quartet based on the play of a retirement home for artists. And in this case, a film that had that cast real opera singers and musicians and comics and singers, and they all live in this kind of retirement community. And what happens when one of the great grand dames of the opera world comes to live in this household, played by Maggie Smith? We find out that her not only her ex-partner but her ex-husband is also living in this community, played by Tom Courtney. Also in the film is Billy Connolly, Michael Gambon. And the film was directed by Dustin Hoffman, who gives a really entertaining commentary track talking about the real musicians and who are extra, everything from extras to small roles to, of course, the big four. And all this building up to a performance. And so it's really nice performances from everybody across the board, and hearing tales of these great musicians who were in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and in some cases 90s, who hung out on set and just performed in between shots. So that was fun checking out. I also revisited The Post, the excellent film about the New York Post and the Pentagon Papers. The Washington Post. The New York Post is a different story altogether, and it's not the Washington, and the New York Times is also been taking a hit in the last week. But this is about the Washington Post and its rise to legitimacy in the journalism world because of the their coverage of the Pentagon Papers. And, of course, you have Josh Singer, one of the screenwriters from Spotlight, working on the screenplay. And this is still relevant today because we're dealing with the paper versus the government. You have the newspaper versus the stockholders. It also helps that you have Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks involved in this. But, of course, I'm one of those that goes through the special features, and I had not watched those yet as far as the making of the film, the look of the film. Fun little nugget about the Post. As you know, Bob Odenkirk and David Cross are both in this film playing reporters. And apparently, director Steven Spielberg knew nothing about their collaborations prior to this. Did not know about Mr. Show and the other programs that Bob and David had worked on. And it wasn't until the end of shooting that Tom Hanks informed Mr. Spielberg of their collaborations. But hearing interviews with Bob and Dave, whenever they're in a scene together, looking at each other and saying, should we tell them? And they decided not to. So my midnight movie last week, as I got home from doing the show Saturday night, was Ip Man 2, Legend of the Grandmaster, starring Donnie Yen. Now, I had seen the first Ip Man. This is the gentleman that would later teach a young Bruce Lee his ways of martial arts. And I remember liking the first Ip Man film because if you're a fan of Bruce Lee and a fan of martial art films, you'll recognize little nuggets along the way. But it's still a pretty good underdog story for the Ip Man character. This time around, it does push that you have Donnie Yen, who has been teaching non-traditional students, meaning non-Asians, or in this case, you have a corrupt group of martial art masters led by Sammo Hung, who's starting to push in on Ip Man's studio work. And teaching his style of martial arts compared to everybody else's. And there are plenty of fights you're waiting for the big showdown between Donnie Yen and Sammo Hung. And it does happen. Donnie Yen's character, Ip Man, will not give shakedown money to Hung and his cronies. And it doesn't turn out to be the climax of the film. There's also, of course, at this time, Hong Kong was under English rule. And this is set in the 50s. In the 1950s. And you would think the Yen and Hung showdown would be the climax of the film. It is not. It is halfway through the film, and we have a secondary story of an English boxer who does there's an exhibition between Western fighting, in this case the English boxer, and Eastern martial arts. And it turns in Ip Man 2 turns into a boxing movie. It turns into boxing cliche movie. Sammo Hung's character winds up having the fight with the English brawler. Remember Rocky IV? Yeah, that happens. And then we get another climactic fight, only this time with the English brawler and Donnie Yen. But we have moments that remind you of Rocky IV and Raging Bull and Rocky II. And there's also a weird thing of a rule change that happens during the climactic fight to give an advantage to the English brawler. Who was a real life fighter and not much of an actor. And at the end of the film, we have a young Bruce Lee, a kid playing Bruce Lee as a kid who makes a cameo. It was a bit of a disappointment, especially when it turned into boxing movie. I guess I was ready for just martial arts movie happening with Ip Man 2. And there's a few more of these. And this was one of those films. I found it at a store for a couple of bucks on Blu-ray because it's two. I don't own one. And yeah, I'm that person. I think I have season 4 of The Wire, and I haven't picked it up and looked at it yet because I need to get seasons 1 through 3. That's just the way my mind works. Good news for costume drama fans or costume comedy fans. My daughter has experienced part 1, or at least the first half, of the miniseries of Pride and Prejudice. Yes, the one with Colin Firth, the one that... that made Colin the art house bohunk of his generation. So hopefully going to be getting to the second half of that next weekend. So far, she's digging it. It's not her first time with Jane Austen. It won't be the last. Because we had primary elections on Tuesday, I revisited Frank Capra's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Or as I wrote on social media, when does Billy Jack show up? Because there is a film actually called Billy Jack Goes to Washington. Not making it up. I own it. Of course, this is Jimmy Stewart as a newly appointed senator who the political machine thinks will be an easy stooge and yes man, and that is not the case. I was reminded of the really nice chemistry between Jimmy Stewart and Jean Arthur. You also have Claude Rains, who's always good, and this is how good an actor Claude Rains is. I forget because the film it's basically on Stewart's shoulders. About the importance of honest government, and he does the great filibuster scene, but I am also reminded of actually a couple things besides Claude Rains. There's near the end of this film, there's some peaceful demonstrations that are hosed down by police, and you have demonstrators in a vehicle who are struck by another ongoing adversarial vehicle, and somebody really ruggedly removed by police at a demonstration who has the opposite opinion of said demonstration. So probably that was the other reason why I watched this last week. But I forgot that an actor as good as Claude Rains can sell what I call the really ridiculous Perry Mason ending that happens when he has a really fast change of heart near the end of the film and fires a gun inside the building and wants to kill himself and wants to, you know, apologize for all the bad doings that he had done through decades of political work. And anyway, it's kind of a Capra ending if Frank Capra directed an episode of Perry Mason. One of the films coming out on Blu-ray this week, and I don't think it has been out on Blu-ray before, but I've not seen this film in a long, long time. The 1983 action film Uncommon Valor. This is with Gene Hackman as a soldier whose son was left missing in action in Vietnam, looking for him for over 10 years and red tape. And finally, he gets a gang of soldiers of different backgrounds and eccentricities, and they're all going to go over, financed by a billionaire played by Robert Stack, who has two scenes, and they're going to go over and take and get his son back. This is 1983. It's directed by Ted Kotcheff, who gave us the first First Blood, as well as North Dallas 40, which I think is his best work to date. That date. In fact, this is the film Kotcheff did after doing First Blood. So, anyway, but Gene Hackman gets a group of soldiers: Fred Ward, Reb Brown, or in my case, Facebook friend Reb Brown, Randall Tex Cobb, Harold Sylvester, Tim Thomerson, and Patrick Swayze. That group pretty much have covered most of the films of the 1970s and 80s with that group. And I believe this was the first of the Bring 'Em Back Home films, because you had Missing in Action and Missing in Action 2, Let's Get Harry. I know Rambo 2 and 3 and anyway. But this was the first, I believe, of the Bring 'Em Back Home films. And it's actually probably the best of the lot. Solid acting from Hackman. The other supporting players bring, like I said, they bring their special skills, their special cinematic skills to the table. You get a young Patrick Swayze who'd already done a handful of films. This is before Dirty Dancing. So, but yeah, decent action film with and Reb Brown has a cinematic way to go, as does Randall Tex Cobb. But yeah, Uncommon Valor, now available on Blu-ray. For Clint Eastwood's, earlier this week, Clint Eastwood celebrated his 90th birthday, and it was around the same time we learned about the death of film composer Lenny Niehaus, which we'll end this week's show with a little Lenny Niehaus, and I'll talk about him in a little bit. But I revisited Million Dollar Baby, which I believe The Onion, the AV Club, had in their list of great films you only want to watch once. Well, I own it, of course. Oscars for Hilary Swank and Morgan Freeman, and it won Best Picture, and Eastwood won his second Best Director. And one of the reasons why it makes the great, you know, great films you only want to see once, Liz, is what turns it, what seems to be a boxing film, and then the last half hour or so, it turns into a completely different film altogether about euthanasia and the right to live. And that's not entirely the case with this film. Revisiting it once again, the recurring theme through this film is somebody getting one more chance. And in the case of Eastwood, it's one more chance at managing and training a champion, one more chance at being a father, a good father, or in this case, a good father figure for the Hilary Swank character. For Hilary Swank's character, it's maybe one more chance at getting in the boxing, even though she's in her early 30s. For Morgan Freeman, and definitely one more chance for Hilary Swank's character to tell off her family. I remember seeing the film, obviously, when it came out, and loved the film. The only issue I had with the film were the cartoon characters known as Hilary Swank's family in this film. That's led by the matriarch of the film, then that lady, now great lady, Margot Martindale, who does as much as she can with really a nothing role. I mean, the character basically says, "I just want the money." But Swank has a great moment when she's in the hospital, who finally tells her family to go away. But and also in Morgan Freeman's case, his character, who was a former boxer, now works at Eastwood's gym, talks about having what happened to him at Fight 109 and wishing he had Fight 110, and he gets that. So everybody has a chance to have one more chance, and to, for the most part, have one more chance and do it right. So anyway, it was good to revisit Million Dollar Baby. I also did it on Election Day, which was a long, exhausting day for me. Probably not the best film to watch while I was in that state, but I did it anyway. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. I'm your host, Matthew Soucy. Okay, friends, grab a pencil. I told you what I watched. Here we go. We start with my buddy Eric on through really nice thorough writing. I wish I could share this with you folks sometime on my email account. But for Eric, his first time viewing of the 2020 drama The Assistant, which he deemed worthwhile. And I also remember really, really liking this from filmmaker Kitty Green. This is a story of an assistant for a movie mogul who could be kind of Weinstein-esque. And it's a great performance from Julia Garner, who is the assistant in this film. And what she has to go through as far as cleaning up and hiding and working, and it's a bit of a gut punch, especially in this. It was a gut punch before we had the pandemic, and even more so with the Me Too movement. So yeah, and it's actually one of the better films of 2020 this year. Still not sure if I'm going to do a best or worst list because of the state we're in right now, but we'll get to that. Also, he watched for the first time the 1945 noir Cornered, starring Dick Powell, which he deemed decent, and then deemed excellent the 2017 film The Florida Project, which I agree, it's the story of a bunch of kids and one mom in particular in a really kind of grungy motel outside of Disney World. Nominated for performance for Willem Dafoe as the manager. This is from Sean Baker, who gave us the film Tangerine as well as American Honey. Really like this. Naturalistic performances by the non-acting children. You've seen these people. You don't necessarily want to live next to them or near them. But as the film goes on, you get to see the vulnerability of these kind of very loud children just trying to be children in the world that they live in. Eric revisited the outstanding 1958 Swedish drama The Magician, the Ingmar Bergman film, which I had also watched about a month or so ago because of the Ingmar Bergman box set. So I'm glad he enjoyed that, as well as 1997's Amistad, which he deemed marvelous. That's one I need to revisit. I think the last time I saw it was when it first came out in 1997. Also deeming excellent the 2007 comedy Waitress. It's funny because I know the film, like the film, I own the film, and it's one that my wife and daughter know the musical really, really, really well. So, and of course, as he wrote in his email, the I can't have no affair because it's wrong and I don't want Earl to kill me pie, vanilla custard with banana, hold the banana. I want a vanilla custard with banana pie, big time. And of course, Matchless, he revisited Casablanca from 1942. What else is there to say? If you've not seen Casablanca, you really need to do something about that. Moving around a little bit because I forgot I had this stuff up here. Of course, we still have a curfew in Marion County, but the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville is up and running. And this weekend, they're showing, interesting double feature here. They're going to start with the 2011 boxing drama Warrior. This is the one with two brothers who mixed martial arts with Tom Hardy, Joel Edgerton, and getting a Best Supporting Actor nomination for his performance as their father, Nick Nolte. That is running with Five Deadly Venoms from 1978. Jenny, that's for you. But yeah, that's really cool double feature, and the fact that you get an older film, something that's over 40 years old, at a drive-through, at a drive-in, I think that's really, really cool. Mark your calendars at the Skyline, June 12th through the 14th. They're going to show Labyrinth and Legend, the 19th through the 21st, Beetlejuice and Night Shift. So you get a Michael Keaton double feature, and then June 26th through the 28th, The Neverending Story and The Goonies. And then the weekend of July 1st, wow, 1989's Intruder. That's Bruce Campbell is involved in that, as well as Sam Raimi, if I remember right. And then 1977's the Frank Cronenberg film Rabid with Marilyn Chambers. That is all happening at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville. Nothing really of note on DVD and Blu-ray this week, except if you are a cult movie fan, if you are a low-budget movie fan, Severin Films has a box set called Al Adamson, The Masterpiece Collection on Blu-ray. 32 movies going from 1960 to, well, a documentary about Al Adamson from 2019. This just came out this week, including Blood and Flesh, The Real Life and Ghastly Death of Al Adamson. It is actually in the cult movie world, it is one of the bigger oddities, mysteries, tragedies in the film world. Some of the titles, The Female Bunch, Psycho A Go-Go, Fiend with the Electronic Brain, Blood of Ghastly Horror, Halfway to Hell, Five Bloody Graves, Blood of Dracula's Castle, Horror of the Blood Monsters, Smashing the Crime Syndicate, a.k.a. The Fakers, Hell's Bloody Devils, Dracula versus Frankenstein, which I saw on Channel 4, not hosted so much by Count Scary, but voiceover by Count Scary, him and his minion assistant doing a kind of an early incarnation of Mystery Science Theater. So you don't see them, but you hear them talk over the Dracula versus Frankenstein, and it was actually helped out that way. Brain of Blood, Satan's Sadist, which I actually own and is autographed. Hi, Grayson. Let's see, Angels, Wild Women, The Naughty Stewardesses, Blazing Stewardesses. You see where we're going. Girls for Rent, Jesse's Girls, Nurses for Sale, Black Heat, The Dynamite Brothers, Mean Mother, Uncle Tom's Cabin, I don't think it's based on the book, The Black Samurai, for you fans of Jim Kelly, Death Dimension, Sunset Cove, Cinderella 2000, Nurse Sherry, Carnival Magic, and Lost. All of these, a 14-disc set on Blu-ray from Severin Films, Al Adamson, The Masterpiece Collection. That'll get some time well served if you're a cult movie fan. So check it out. Al Adamson, The Masterpiece Collection. Okay, now we will grab a pencil and let's see what you have watched. Joe, our very own Joe here at WFYI on Twitter. I watched V for Vendetta a few nights ago. Thank you, Joe. Lou on before I get to Lou, sorry, Lou. Stacey Studeville, who has been a guest on this show many times, especially when we talk about movies with our kids. Things we've watched with Maya. Started Moulin Rouge and then started telling her about Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet. So we switched and watched that. She thinks young Leo is so cute. Need to show that to Emma again. Little Shop of Horrors. I'm assuming that's the musical. Knives Out. Murder on the Orient Express. I'm assuming that's Kenneth Branagh's version. And once again, Beetlejuice. So thank you, Stacy. Got to get you back on the show when we can actually be in the studio, although I guess a phone order is okay. Okay, back to Facebook. Lou Harry says he watched Sword of Truth, really liked the first half, fell apart at the compound. Eric writes Uncut Gems, Solo, and American Psycho. Joan writes Hidden Figures. Thomas doesn't write something. He just put up the GIF of James Franco as Tommy Wiseau coming out of the door and yelling, blowing the line by saying, "I hit her." So either he watched The Room or The Disaster Artist or both. Either way, way to go, Thomas. Corey writes, "Finally saw Rocket Man and I am a woman obsessed." Christian writes, "Inception. How had I never seen this before?" Lost in Translation. How did I not notice how racist this is back in 2003? Christian, it's all in the timing. Joni writes, "I haven't watched a film in a week or so, but we have been enjoying The Women in White on PBS. My son rewatched Uncut Gems the other day. We have yet to watch that." Chris writes, "The original Wicker Man." Wayne writes, "Uncut Gems, I See You, South Pacific." Oh, Uncut Gems, then the film I See You, and then South Pacific. Eric writes, "The Desperate Hours. I seem to be on a bogey kick. Plus Frederick March in a wonderful performance as a father feeling immense pressure to keep his family safe." I understand, Eric. Jose writes, "Jeffrey Epstein, Filthy Rich, and Never Surrender, a Galaxy Quest documentary." I need to see that. That title keeps popping up, and I need to check that out. Scott writes, "Interstellar, and I Walk the Line with Gregory Peck and Tuesday Weld." I own that on DVD, Scott, so well done. Beverly writes, "The Help." Joellen writes, "The Jerk, I Needed a Laugh." I got a few of those "I Needed a Laugh" comments this week. Chloe writes, "Moonlight, Logan Lucky, Her, and The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson." Jamie writes, "We are watching The Aristocats right now and watched DuckTales the movie Treasure of the Lost Lamp yesterday." Sharon writes, "Bridesmaids, also needed laughs." Kim writes, "The Trip to Greece. Then we realized we never saw The Trip to Spain, so we watched that the following night. Lastly, Becoming, which is the Michelle Obama documentary. Cheers and hugs." Thank you, Kim. Darren writes, "Duck Soup, Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, and Feudin' Fools." Andrew writes, "Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? Honestly, one of the funniest movies ever made." And of course, that was Spencer Tracy's final performance. I believe he died like a couple days after filming that, and him doing that monologue at the end is a real gut punch for me. I always wind up in tears after Spencer Tracy's monologue and his exit. David writes, "1917, great story of friendship and duty. Excellent photography. Love the way scenes seem to go on forever, as if it's one continuous take." That's right. Jeff writes, "Watched Luc Besson's Anna." Mark writes, "I'm watching the real-life doc movie of our nation lurching toward chaos. It's a documentary shot with multiple camera angles in many locations and played out over a fairly long period. It's depressing. I am doing what I can." And I responded to Mark by saying, "Watch Fandango. Distract yourself." Jesse writes, "Seberg, as well as My Man Godfrey." Sam writes, "We rewatched Big. What a sweet, beautiful movie. Also rewatched Swingers and Punchline." Nick writes, "The Cotton Club, the 2019 Encore Cut." I reviewed that, Nick, earlier in the pandemic. So cool you saw that. Blue Story, Jack's Back, Three Brothers, Radio Raheem, Eric Garner, and George Floyd, Do the Right Thing, good timing, Ordinary Love, and True History of the Kelly Gang. George writes Madrid, 1987. David writes Tombstone. Molly writes, "We watched Paul and Galaxy Quest, then Rocky Horror Picture Show, since we'd watched a science fiction double feature." Very cute, Molly. A picture show. Andrew writes, "Wages of Fear and Sorcerer double bill." Wow. That's very strong. Next stop, Greenwich Village on the schedule for tonight. Yes, Shelley Winters and Antonio Fargas have a nice dance in that one. Melissa writes, Animal Crackers, the Marx Brothers film. I also needed a laugh. Daniel writes, The Furies, The Great Houdini from 1976, The Story of Adele H., Funny Face, The Jungle Book, On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. Yes, musicals with Jack Nicholson. Diane, that's the film with Mary Kay Place. Dick Tracy, My Beautiful Laundrette, The Star, Phantom Thread, Road to Rio, and Only Lovers Left Alive. Melissa writes, only film I've watched all week was Joker, which I at least finally got around to watching. All right, Melissa. Joe writes, Joe Shearer, In Search of the Last Action Heroes, which I need to check out as well, Joe. What We Left Behind, looking back at Star Trek, Deep Space Nine, Nesting Dolls, and The Lovebirds. Jay writes, The Upside with Kevin Hart and Bryan Cranston. We liked it a lot. Abby Terzini, one of our voices here at WFYI. I watched Rocket Man, the Elton John movie, the other day, not the Harlan Williams movie. Thank you, Abby. I kind of got that. Rachel writes, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade and The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. Ty wrote in all caps, Dr. Detroit. My goodness. Well, he did meet Donna Dixon on that one, so there's something good out of that. Rosanna writes, Captain Fantastic with You Know Who. Rosanna's a big Viggo Mortensen fan. The 13th, A New Kind of Love. That's Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward. The Healer, dedicated to Paul Newman. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. A Patch of Blue. Raisin in the Sun. It was a big movie week for me. Tired of old TV series. I understand. Britt writes, Hotel Artemis. Lost in Space. Brigadoon. The Cat's Meow. Knives Out. The Heat. Again. Birds of Prey, the Harley Quinn film. Ms. Henderson Presents, Jurassic Park, The Lost World, Year One, Black Klansman, and Jess Mercy. And finally, Lisa chimes in with The Betsy, Jess Mercy, and Dolores Claiborne. Lisa, I hope you didn't watch The Betsy and Dolores Claiborne in the same day. There's a recurring plot point theme in both of those, and nobody needs that. Anyway, I hope you're doing all right. And that's it, folks. So thank you so much for all of your films that you've watched. And please keep them coming on Thursdays on the Twitter as well as Facebook for me. And it's been fun to hear, and it's been fun to hear people say, I watched so-and-so because it was brought up during the show or was brought up on your Facebook page. And I wind up doing these myself because there are certain titles I'm like, I have in the pile of movies that I bought. And I just haven't gotten around to it. So we will see. I have a couple dead people we like because we never have time for dead people we don't like. Herb Stemple passed away earlier this week at the age of 93. And Herb Stemple is best known. He was one of the contestants on 24, which was the part of 21, I should say. Not 24, sorry, Kiefer, but he was a part of the quiz show scandals of the 1950s. And, of course, he was portrayed by John Turturro in the great Robert Redford-directed film Quiz Show from 1994. A great excuse to revisit that film, you should. I watched it earlier this week with friends, and I might have to check that out again. We'll get to our second Hollywood obituary, dead person we like, in a moment. First, friends. Some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
We're going to end this week's show with a tribute to musician, composer, orchestrator Lenny Niehaus, who passed away earlier this week at the age of 90. Was a jazz player in his own right, played with the likes of Stan Kenton, as well as a band leader in his own right, as I said, and did a number of soundtracks, most notably working with Clint Eastwood several times. What I didn't know until I got to his IMDb page, received a lot of uncredited work as an orchestrator, conductor, for films such as Hunters Are for Killing, which was a 1970 TV movie with Burt Reynolds. Lawman, the Burt Lancaster Western. Johnny Got His Gun. The Nightcomers. Straw Dogs. Chatto's Land. The Mechanic. Scorpio. The Outfit. The Super Cops. Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. The Gambler, this is the James Caan film. The Killer Elite, The Black Bird, The Bad News Bears. His first time working with Clint Eastwood, 1976's The Outlaw Josie Wales. The Enforcer, Demon Seed, Semi-Tough, The Gauntlet, Gray Lady Down, The Big Sleep, Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, Escape from Alcatraz, Under the Volcano, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Follow That Bird, yes, and Back to School, among others. Also did orchestrated work on The Two Jakes. Going through this, I was intrigued to see what films he did that didn't involve Clint Eastwood, and I just rattled a bunch of them off. Some of his work with Clint includes, Tightrope, City Heat, Pale Rider, non-Clint film, Never Too Young to Die, as well as Rat Boy, that was directed by Sandra Locke, produced by Clint Eastwood. Also worked with Eastwood on Bird. That's one, and I needed to check with Brian Hertz brought this to my attention. But this was the soundtrack. This was the biopic about Charlie Parker. Forrest Whitaker playing, doing a great job as Charlie Parker. The soundtrack has Charlie Parker's saxophone tracks, but dubbed over or mixed in with new recordings by everybody else. I believe Christian McBride and some modern players from the 80s. So it's kind of the first jazz mashup, kind of like Natalie Cole and Nat King Cole being morphed together musically. So Brian said that this set a precedent as far as rule changes in the best score category. And I need to double check that and make sure that's true. But thank you, Brian, for bringing that to my attention. Other works, White Hunter, Black Heart, The Rookie, Unforgiven, A Perfect World, Bridges of Madison County, Absolute Power, True Crimes, Space Cowboy, and Bloodwork. His last credit as a composer was for Comanche Moon. Now, and even in the films that Clint Eastwood is credited with doing the score, was the conductor and was the orchestrator to Clint Eastwood scores, like Mystic River, among others. So the other thing I found doing research on Lenny, never received an Academy Award nomination. I'm kind of surprised at that. A couple of Primetime Emmy nominations winning in 1994 for Lush Life, a BAFTA nomination for Bird, Awards Circuit Community Awards for the score of Unforgiven, winner of 3 BMI Film and TV Awards for Space Cowboys, Bridges of Madison County, Unforgiven, and Heartbreak Ridge, as well as a nominee in the Los Angeles Film Critics Association's Award for Bird. What's interesting listening to his scores, especially with the Eastwood films, is how simple and low-key they are, even when you have a full orchestra behind you. It's sparse and lovely at the same time. So with that in mind, as I said, a song that was co-written by Eastwood and Lenny and orchestrated by Lenny from Unforgiven, it's known as Claudia's Theme. So friends, go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Stay safe, stay sane, stay healthy, and be good to one another. Here's music from Unforgiven until next week. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!